Oh, I'm Private Fred Reese, born here in the city of Winnipeg, enlisted in Winnipeg Grenadiers in 39. I'd never been in the NPAM, my first experience as a soldier, and actually never ever regretted enlisting, volunteering in the Army. Would do it again if the same circumstances arise. We first went to the West Indies for about a year and a half, and was in the last draft coming back from the West Indies. I was only in Winnipeg for about 10 days and went to Vancouver to go to Hong Kong. I spent about the first 2 years in China and spent the last 2 years in a coal mine, Sendai, in Japan.
In China, do you mean like in Hong Kong or in Kowloon, or were you further inland in China?
Oh, well, originally, like the camps were all like we were in China proper to start with, but then, like, of course, we evacuated the mainland, went over to the island, and when the island, we were in a group that were actually taken prisoner. Like, there's a little bit of differences that came up at that time, because like A Company, the Winnipeg Grenadiers, like, actually went to the invasion spot where the Japs invaded the island, and after a couple of days we were actually taken prisoners, where the remainder of the complete force, the island capitulated on Christmas Day. We were taken prisoner on the 19th of December, and the island, of course, capitulated on Christmas Day, the 25th. And even in them days, I remember a little bit of talk where a prisoner of war was entitled to actually more rations than somebody like in the same category who capitulated would be considered like a civilian or something like that. But I forget in what sequences the camps were on, like the bigger camps. We were all the same, like in the island for a while, and then they transferred us to a big camp.
That would be North Point, would
it? North Point to start with, yeah. And then I forget when they took us, like the Sham Chapo. This was actually the camp that we started off with when we landed in Kowloon. Yeah.
That was your original barracks, wasn't it?
That was our original barracks, yes.
Do you remember much about the garrison duty before the war broke out, like Hong Kong itself before the war broke out? Have much of a chance to get around and see things?
No, actually, we never had really that much time, because from the time we left Vancouver, I remember we went to, it took us 3 weeks to get to Hong Kong, and I remember my birthday was November the 30th, and I had, I don't know what it was, shingles or something like that, and for 3-4 days I wasn't really too interested in anything. And at that time there was the threat of war was always imminent, although like our people, our propaganda, you know, the Japs wouldn't dare do anything like that, you know, and they were concentrating, for instance, a lot more on just parade square work like that. Like there's many times they said that a lot of our fellows couldn't fire a 303 rifle. Well, this is the truth, but the thing is, they weren't really our fellows. Like originally, the Grenadiers was only like a heavy machine gun battalion. There was only 600 of us, and we were picked like to hear from MD-10. We were the best trained regiment like in the area. Mm-hmm. But once we went to the West Indies, they took away our heavy machine guns and made us an infantry battalion. And just prior to leaving to go for Hong Kong, oh, we must have got about 700 reinforcements. And a lot of these reinforcements, it might not be nice to say, but they're the reject from every regiment from Halifax going west. And a lot of these fellows, they certainly not, they should never have been even allowed to enlist in the service. A lot of them were just unfit, that's all there's to. But they did rifle, whereas all of us were you could fire like a Vickers machine gun blindfolded. Every original grenadier had to do that. We were the one the first to have the Bren machine gun. We were first to had the Lewis, and we also fired the anti-tank rifle. So the original grenadier, like their training, like I say, we were selected to go to this garrison duty because I guess we were the best trained regiment in MD-10, although it didn't do us no good. And after being there for an hour and a year and a half, well, you forget all these things anyway. So when I got to China, like I say, they put more emphasis on trying to compete with the Imperials there, that we can right wheel and left wheel and make straighter lines and all that and that. But I think a lot of this had to do with our higher echelon. Like I often said, that like our senior officers that we had with the grenadiers were very, very inefficient. They weren't soldiers in the sense like the Germans or Japanese or professional. Even the English soldier was a high-class soldier in comparison to what we had like in the NPM, like the non-permanent army militia. Bunch of school teachers and bunch of bums actually who got something that they weren't entitled to, and they really were just playing soldiers. They didn't know what to do. But we after we're taking prisoners, a lot of sickness, and then we're just actually just working on different jobs. I do remember like this Kitek airport, and there was an awful lot of people working in there, and built the best airfield in the Far East by just Chinese coolie labor and ourselves. And then the Shell Oil, I remember, had a really big plant there. I guess that was one of the first things that they hit and bombed. And there was a lot of work after that.
Do you remember much about the battle, what you were doing in the battle, and where you were? You were with A Company, were you?
Yes. Yes. Well, there too was a big schmozzle. I remember like A Company comprised of 7, 8, 9 and company headquarters. And one platoon, funny as may seem, like I think it was 8 platoon, they actually got lost in the dark. We had a rendezvous, like we were told, like this one night, okay, everybody in marching order, full battle dress for marching. Jap paratroopers had landed on the island and were going to go there and mop them up. Well, apparently there was a rendezvous. There was this one shy gap or wherever it was. We're all supposed to meet there and then go to where these paratroopers had landed. Well, this was like in the middle of the night, and we finally got there in a certain time. Like this one platoon was missing, and we decided we had to go without them. We never seen them until we ended up in China a few weeks later. And I remember like walking all night, and we were actually going the wrong direction. And after we going through these paddy fields, and everybody had enough ammunition to sink a mule, where there's a million of them around there, like it's a job at them all, though. But we finally got somewhere in the morning, and then they realized that we were actually in the wrong way. We had to go in another direction there. And just about like sunrise, I remember we ended up in the top of a range of hills. And that was in the first we spotted, like this was the main Japanese invasion force that's come across to the island. Well, we were shocked because it was just like watching a parade like in Portage and Maine from the distance. If you just come in, I don't know, but 60,000 men, there's 70,000 men in the invasion force, and they were coming just 3 abreast, just like a real power play parade. And we were sitting way up on top of this hill and looking down, and it just looked like ants coming along. And this was altogether different from the few paratroopers that were supposed to have landed on the island. And I forget how many there was of us. We had, like I say, part of A Company, and we had some Royal Scots with us. We had some Indians who were supposed to be in our second line of defense, one to be fell back to, but the Indians as a whole deserted to the Japanese anyway. We're all the Indians there, as far as I'm concerned, were for the Japanese. They were not for the British. They detested the white people. And until they got in, within range of our heavy, we had about 5 Vickers machine guns. Well, until that time, until we could reach them, the Vickers machine guns were just as bold as brass. We weren't concerned. And this is when the fight actually started. Well, they started to come, and we started to run. Well, we only lasted, wasn't very long. And there, too, like I say, people we had, like, in charge of us, they were completely, they didn't know nothing. They were rattled. It was nothing but confusion. And in fact, we ended up where we actually did surrender. We were actually going to the, just over this mountain was where the 60 or 70,000 Japanese invasion force was parked right over there with all their munitions and stuff like that. In fact, when they got us, that we had to unload this here big sort of, not a ship, but a big barge or something, their ammunition. Mm-hmm. Finally, they took us like over on that barge over to the mainland and put us in there's a little camp there like it used to be for some officers. I'm not sure what it was, like Imperials. And I remember we went in there, but
is it Argyle?
Argyle, that's right. And I remember we went in there. We were the first lot of prisoners. I remember as we came down the main streets there, like in Kowloon, you know, like we spent the first night in some monastery there. And of course, the people, our people, like who were still in the mainland there, like we were walking there, lots of them crippled and wounded and bloody. And I guess we looked an awful bloody mess, you know. And I guess our people feared, well, it was despair, right, rock bottom gloom, you know. And I remember when we moved into this Argyle camp, because we had a bunch of mules there, we had to clean it out, we had a lot of wounded there. I remember we were carrying one guy, McKillop, he's a lieutenant with us. He came from Bartlett Ferry, and he was hit in the back with some shrapnel there, and I remember we carried him, I don't know how far, and finally cleaned out a stall there and threw some hay down from the kelp to lay on, and he was dead within an hour or two. We saved all that effort. He was more or less in a coma all the time it took him anyway.
Did they treat you pretty roughly when they first took you prisoner, or were they fair?
Oh, no. To start with, you must realize that the Jap soldier who was engaged in the front line, he was an animal, you could say. They were, I guess, their propaganda. They hated everything that was white. And they just assumed they'd kill us and give us a drink of water. In fact, I do know, like, even after we surrendered, and I do remember that there was one Jap interpreter there hollering, you know, throw everything away. Empty out your pockets. Rings, wallets, handkerchiefs, cigarettes. Everything, throw it on the ground. And some of our fellows, well, don't surrender, they're going to kill us all. And others, well, it's no use, surrender, you know. And the odd fellow was firing at the Japanese, where the Japanese were all around us and throwing grenades, and the snipers were having a real payday there. And till finally we surrendered. But remember, they made us walk through some little field there. It looked like a goat pasture or some damn thing. And I remember we had two brothers from Carmen, the Land Brothers. And we're going through this pasture like with our hands up. And I remember this one Land Brother, his brother was killed a couple of hours earlier back. And I think it was a Royal Land. I remember he had a grenade and he pulled the pin out and was just going by a Jap machine gun nest and threw this big grenade. And there were 3 or 4 of them buggers they hauled. But then I remember after that, they took about every 8th, 9th, 10th guy, you know, and just dragged them out, and some tore the clothes off, just bayoneted them, and killed about every 9th fellow. I remember my brother-in-law's brother was right ahead of me. I thought they were coming to me, my heart was in my mouth too, you know. But I remember they came and they grabbed and nicked out and just dragged them a couple of yards off the path, more or less, and just 3, 4, 5, 6 guys just painted them. And I remember B.B. Whalen, another guy who was right with the area right at the end where I was, and like they did the same thing to him. I always remember him yelling and screaming. Some of them didn't say nothing, some of them screamed a lot. But they took a lot of delight, and it seemed to me some of them had pick handles and hit you in the head with these bloody pick handles and hit you with the rifle butt and just cake you. They hated us, and that's all there was to. It wasn't until later on that the Canadian got, I'd say, a little bit better treatment than the English. I mean, I guess they figured we were entitled to a few more breaks than the English were. In later days, like, of course, they hated the Americans the most. And like I said, this was their propaganda machine, and it was a very, very efficient one. But, like, I had a lot of illness, and all these jobs that we're on. There too, the amusing part is, like, every one of us had a volunteer, like, to go to Japan. Well, we discussed this many times, and it was always our opinion, well, there'd be no war like in Japan. They're supposed to be a civilized country, and they're bound to have hospitals and a lot more food. And consequently, like, everybody actually had a volunteer, like, to go to Japan. And this was the most ironical thing I think that we ever did, because in Japan it was 100% worse than it was in China. Where in China you did a lot of work, but it was not the amount of work. Whereas once we went to Japan, like once we started going down this mine, for instance, we used to work 14 days. The 15th day was a day of rest, so-called Yasumi day. Well, they worked you more on the 15th day up above the ground than you did when you were down the mine. But when you went down the mine, like, everybody was on a quota system. And we had like the two shifts, and when we were on days, like for instance, 6 o'clock in the morning, we were going down, the Maggie man would let us go down the mine. We're never late. If it rained, you'd sometimes form an endless chain, but at 6 o'clock, you was at the face of that mine and went down there. And you'd have 4 men or 5 men in the gang, and you were given, depending how far, how many rail lengths you were in, you were given a quota to work to do. And you didn't come up until the quota was finished. Like, towards the end, there were a lot of air raids. And air raid that cut off the power. So if you sat in the darkness, you'd always have to feel and get underneath some timbering there, because, like, the ground was very volcanic and stuff like that. Right in the cave-ins and stuff like that. But after a couple of hours, the lights went down again, you continued with your work. And you still had to do the same amount of work when you put your couple of hours behind. And they wouldn't allow, for instance, one gang to help any other gang. Every gang had a quota of work to do, and nobody went up until the last gang was finished their work. Well, in China, like, we all worked so many hours, but if you worked more or less, they were always behind you, giving you a kick or a clout in the head or something like that, but it wasn't the same as, like, piece work as you had to do, like, in Japan. And if anything, like, the food in Japan was no better than it was in China. In fact, it was worse. And the temperature was actually colder. I was lucky enough to end up down a coal mine there. And just working with G-string, I always felt the cold. If I'd been in some of the shipyards and some of the mines where they just did the surface work, I'm sure I'd never left that lovely country. So I was glad to get down to mine, at least I got warm, like in the winter time. But, I don't know, it's so long ago that, you know, so many things, they look easier. I always remember, like, when we landed, like, in Tokyo, and their first experience, like, with the Japanese, I mean, like, in Japan, we landed, I don't know, it looked like as if it was an old immigration halls or something like that, and we come down this here, we were aboard this, Tatsuo Maru, some old freighter, and everybody, there's a lot of diarrhea, dysentery, everybody was lousy, and come down the gangplank there, and there was about 4 Japs with tanks on, masks on, and they sprayed us from the top of our head right to the bottom there, and lined us up there. And well, we had nothing. You know, it was an immigration hall, I think, but there was nothing that we were bringing in outside of ourselves and our germs and lice and stuff like that. But I do remember, like, they took us from there to a place where we had to catch a train. And there wasn't that many of us. There's only about, say, 225 or something like that. But I do remember it wasn't very long that, God, there's... seemed to me hundreds of thousands of Japanese and like women, children, men, everything else. And we had to have the lousy Jap army there to protect us. I think the people would have tore us limb from limb. They had run out and spit on you and kick you and slap you and threw rocks at you. And the Japs were actually protecting us from their own people. But I guess at this time already they were suffering lots of adverse and defeats in different parts of the war. And naturally, they're pressed. They get blamed it all on the our people. And that's like saying, anybody was white, it was something to take out your feelings on, you know. But in Japan, like the whole country, you must understand, in them days, we're all under uniform. Everybody had a uniform, but a different type of uniform. And some of the civilians, and as we found out, like when we got down the mine, like the miners, like while they were up under the surveillance of the military and stuff like that, or they were just as cool or just as mean, but still the odd time you'd get somebody alone, and even sometimes the odd sentry would come along where there's nobody else watching them, you know, give you a cigarette and sort of sympathize with you. But I guess it was just they had something like the train by the SS that is told, you know, where you couldn't trust your own brother or mother and you had to be rough and tough. Or the punishment they'd give their own people would be just the same as they'd give us, you know. Like, sometimes the odd fellow was caught like black market and trading with some of our fellows, you know. Well, they would just turn and get them out there, and about 10 of their own men might go to work and just knock him senseless. And there's no such thing as crime sheet. He was caught, he was punished, and that's the end of it. But don't do that again, and very seldom ever did it twice. But I guess maybe I'm a bit, I've often said like they were not human like the Germans, I found a lot of people, who were, for instance, prisoners of war in the Yep. And no doubt like their SS were tough and brutal, and they had a program like they wanted to exterminate the Jews, but a lot of like our prisoners of war were like they'd say, well, for instance, their food was terrible. Like they'd have a sausage there that was, it was so bad you couldn't eat it, or black bread, you know, it was so poor. Well, hell, we never had anything like that. If anything we had, you ate it. That's all they were sleeping. So, and then like they got a Red Cross parcel once a month, whereas I got 3 1/4 Red Cross parcels. And whereas the Japanese plundered the whole works of this and supplied their hospitals. But in my opinion, like the Jap, and this was, I guess, with their lousy religion and the propaganda, but they weren't human beings, whereas like the Germans, like I still figure, they were really a perfect military machine, but still they had a little bit of decency amongst mm-hmm. them. I mean, they might shoot you and kill you like to in a fight, but not like a sadistic bunch of people like the Japanese in there.
Did you have to suffer any beatings? Did they catch you doing anything that they beat you up for?
Well, like in our camp, I remember like the one occasion, they had a phobia there. If you ever stood around, they have having a button on them or your hands in your pocket. We had one little jerk there. It looked like a comic afterwards. And you don't know him. And I remember he came around once and he slapped me a few times and had my hands in my pocket. And I made the mistake, and I don't think I had my hands in my pockets. Mm-hmm. And I made a mistake of arguing the point with him, you know. And well, that was the end of it right then and there. I really got kicked, and it was about half my height, and he kicked and slapped and slapped and slapped. And then I remember he gave me a stone there. I don't know how big it was. It wasn't that big, but if you hold a stone like that for any length of time, it feels like as big as a house. Stay there till tomorrow morning or something like that. And well, this was impossible, see. So after, well, I know how long I did hold it, and these jobs come out, well, the snow's getting lower and lower, and come, bang, 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 hit, 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 you know, up it went again. But I certainly didn't stay right till the morning, because I couldn't have possibly done it, you know. But for a few hours, it made me stay like that and hold it up as good as I can, and then got a couple more slaps, and don't argue with them, they're always right, we're always wrong. And I agreed with them, and that's all they understood. But I do know, like, we had one fellow that was very amusing, was very hot-tempered. Jack Lynn was his name. And we had one Jap miner on there. Some of them are real malicious, too, and he was a holy terror. And I always remember, like, Jack Lynn, he made a mistake, he lost his temper, and he hauled off, and he hit him. Oh, Jesus, that was it. They stopped everything. It was the only time they ever took some guy up to the mine, stopped and took him upstairs, and they had what they call like a hisa. Hisa was like a jail, a punishment room. But, oh, I'm not sure that the dimensions are, I don't imagine it's more than 5 feet anyway, see? I mean, you couldn't stretch out the corner to corner, you know. I remember they took Jack then up there, and, oh, for 3 days or so, they like nothing to eat or nothing to drink. And periodically they'd take him out and just knock the hell out of him and throw him back in there again, like for daring to hit a Japanese. Well, every Japanese that we've seen, like, the years, 2 years we were locked up, you had to salute everyone and bow to everyone, you know. Many times they tell us, well, if we behave ourselves and we're good, like, and they're going to win the war, and after 20 years or so, if we're good, they leave us go back to our own country. But it was very pronounced, like, the last 6 months of the war, the Japanese had nothing to eat and defend the island with. Like, there was no anti-aircraft firing going up. You'd never seen a Japanese plane. They only had two seals there that they had some planes in reserve for what they figured would be the actual invasion of Japan. But our people were coming over continuously, and the Jap feeling, and I heard him say to himself, you know, like, sensu, like war is like sensu, the war, the sooner the war is over, the better it is for us all, you know. I actually seen like Japs cheering, like, see these B-29s in groups, single, and maybe three, and the odd group of nine, but they practically never know when the drone of one go, and you'd hear another one starting somewhere else, you know. But then they realized that the war was lost, and there too, that everything was rationed for them people. They had nothing. Well, they could get like some fruit that we couldn't get, like, locked up, but everything, like oil or a little bit of fish, like a fishing fleet, anything that left the coast, well, was sunk. That was all there too. And there was nothing in the way of clothes or like sugar, was nothing. There was none there. And these people had been doing without it for years too, and I guess they were sick and tired of it, and they sort of didn't believe the old malarkey that the old military was giving them, that they were going to win, and the emperor was going down considerably in their eyesight, and till finally, they capitulated, and that was the end of the ball game.
Do you remember the food bombers coming over?
Oh yeah, I got. When the first morning that they surrendered, I remember, was quite an occasion, because, like I say, we were always down at the face of the mine at 6 o'clock, and this morning we were all lined up ready to go. The previous day we knew something was wrong, because, like, as a rule, like, they all bow to the sun, like, every morning and every night, you know. And this was around 11 o'clock in the afternoon, like it was like an evening shift. And boy, we could see them bowing and praying, and some of them were crying, and boy, they were mad, like, and suddenly, as peeping out the little cracks or knotholes, and they were kicking and so slapping in. Anybody caught spying out anything, they'd shoot, and that was the end of them. And they were in a bad mood, and we knew that things were going bad for them, but we didn't, naturally, we were way out of date. Well, apparently, like, they had dropped this atom bomb, And they realized that they were trying to negotiate a peace already and surrender, and I guess this really shocked them. And we figured that there was something, we didn't know what, but we knew there was something to win. And like the next morning we woke up like all ready for work, and we watched, and the miners weren't there, and they were all Jap, and the Japs stayed there, guards stayed there, and all of a sudden 6 o'clock, oh, something's wrong, you know. Still nobody broke the rank unless you had to go to the can, and this was allowed, you know, you just tell me you're going to Benjamin. Until about 6:45, like our doctor, old Schmeling, our camp commandant, came out there. And we were lucky, our camp commandant, he used to be a school teacher, he could speak perfect English. And started some spiel, and our old Schmeling says, well, it's something to tell you. He says, I don't know whether it's official or not, he says, but I'll give it to you straight. He says, I've been told that the war is over, the Japanese have capitulated. And he says, from there on, I'll let the Japanese camp commandant to talk to you. So he started off, the dove of peace has come, and this and that. He really gave a spiel, he's quite an orator. And, anyway, he suggested we keep on our normal routine and go down the mine. And but he said, we'll leave that up to you. You still want to go down the mine? And then everybody opened their mouth. Are you kidding? But like when they talked, I like not a word. You know, nobody minded. They told us here so many times, the war is over, the war is over. You know, and nobody says nothing. Not like you see in the movies. You know, and cheer. In fact, you hardly heard a noise. You know, in fact, the odd couple of guys started to cry. You know, and well, that was it. So the only difference was for a couple of days they gave us the keys for the rations, and we ate whatever food there was. As much as we wanted to, pretty well. And until then, the Japs, remember one night, the whole guard just vanished overnight, you know. And we took over the radio, and then they said, well, put some red crosses on the building or something like that. And this is what we did do. And the first bunch of supplies, I left, the first bunch of food they dropped was right on top of the kitchen, into our cookhouse. I think they had 2 or 3 fellows killed the first day there. Like one fellow was in the toilet, and they used to come over the B-29s, and they had like 4x4 framework and some parachutes at either end. And but then they had drums like peaches or pears, and once they'd come out, and once the chute opened up, just was a tug and it would break. And I remember one guy drove him right into the latrine there, killed him stone dead. One guy cut off his legs and peak of a shack there, you know. And this happened in all the camps, because then they asked us to put a Red Cross sign out in some level ground the best we could find. And I remember we did that. And I always remember it was amusing that once they, I remember they dropped like these big drums, and some of it was grape jelly and sauerkraut, and all them fields were like covered with, from the latrines, you know, they're all wet, and some of them different stages of water, you know, but all the human filth from all the villages. And it hit there, and bang, spread wide open, grape jelly all over this muck, and sauerkraut and another part of it, and all the Japs, you know, any container they could get, they didn't hook there getting this grape jelly or getting the sauerkraut. Well, even us, like, if we ever had a chance, like walking through that, like you'd get a carrot or something like that, and then, you know, this filth, you just wipe it off your pants, although you knew about the dysentery, and you were that hungry, you didn't give a shit if you dead the next day, you were going to eat it, and that's all there is to. And same thing, these people, and they sure had a heyday. And the Americans dropped everything, like we put in different markings for different types of what we required there, you know, but they dropped us more than what we needed of everything. I can't speak too highly of the Americans, in my opinion. I will often say that I want to see this be part of the United States of America. I don't like the country the way it is, and I think it's deteriorated very, very bad. And like I say, I'm strictly pro-American, more than 100%.
How did you get from Sendai down to back to Canada? Down? Did you take a train?
No, like where we were, this quite far north, you know, and. We were one of the last group, in fact, the time I got back to Winnipeg, I forget when it was, there was only 2 of us in the troop train, spanking. Well, we started off in Victoria, and then went over to, his people lived in Chilliwack. So we spent a couple of weeks there, but I do remember when we came back, practically everybody who was coming back here was back already, but I remember we went, our group, we went in the troop train, went to Tokyo, and I remember old MacArthur was there to greet us, and a bunch of Red Cross girls, and giving us this and that, and we went first, spent that one night on an American transport ship, and then they took us from there aboard the USS Iowa, where we spent about, three and a half weeks aboard the USS Iowa. We were supposed to come back with them on the Navy Day Parade to San Francisco. And, they couldn't do enough for us, you know. As far as the treatment, like anything you needed, as far as medical treatment, naturally, they went to work on you right away. A few minor operations and stuff like that. And we were having a real picnic, but every day we were getting more and more prisoners of war, and a lot of their own, you know. So I do remember once, like, they have, like, a captain, and then they have what they call, administrator officer, I believe it is, and it's more or less two IC in the ship. And he called us all out there, and he says, well, anybody who wanted to, they would fly us home, because they're getting more than they can handle, you know, like, amongst their own troops. And I always remember there wasn't one hand, there were a lot of, I was single at that time, but we had a lot of married men with us, you know. There wasn't one man who held up his hand that to get flown home. And I always remember he laughed and he says, I think he paid us the nicest compliment we've ever received. He said, just for that, he says, we're going to fly every one of you bastards home. He says, make preparations, you're all going. Well, from there, like, we went off to the USS, we were in the bay, like in Tokyo there, and there was terrific ships there, like. But anyway, we went back from the USS Iowa, we went back to Tokyo, and then we went from Tokyo by air. From Tokyo, I remember we went to Iwo Jima. Well, Iwo Jima was only there for about 48 hours. And from Iwo Jima, we went to Guam. In Guam, they had a big hospital there already, and they automatically stopped in these hospitals until you got like a lot of people, I had worms and had been treated like for amoebic dysentery, you know, and until you got a pretty bill of health, and then you send you on. Well, I spent about 2-3 weeks in Guam, and then from Guam, I went to Guadeloupe, that's in the Marshall Islands, and then from Guadeloupe, we went to Honolulu, and there's a great big hospital that the Americans built there, you know. I spent about 3-4 weeks in this hospital in Hawaii, and from there we went down to Oakland, to San Francisco, and I remember Angel Island was the first place we ever hit any Canadian troops. Well, at this time we were sort of attached to the American Navy, and once we got to the island, Angel Island, there was a Canadian captain there, giving us, outfitting us with a Canadian uniform, rifle, equipment. We said, don't even want it, you gotta take it, you know. So we laughed, well, most of us were a bunch of crippled in us, because we didn't want it. Useless, senseless, you know. But we had to anyway, and but then is when we decided, well, this is enough. Now we want to go home. So I remember I spent, I don't know, a week, 10 days in Angel Island, and then we went down across to San Francisco, and then went down to Portland, to Seattle, and from Seattle we went to a ferry to Victoria, and then I spent a few days in the hospital in Victoria. Then I went across to Shaughnessy in Vancouver, and I started, and I got my discharge there, and I started my leave, and spent a couple of extra weeks around there, and then came back to Winnipeg.
You got your discharge while you were in Vancouver?
No. I just started
just
my leave.
Just a leave,
yeah.
I see. Yeah.
No, I didn't get my discharge till the following April. Who was it? April the 1st in 46. I was getting needles and everything, like all the time I was there, and even when I was here, but I got my discharge, like I say. I remember that day, I was very fitting, April Fool's Day, 1946.
Did you have adverse effects that stuck with you after the war, like from the diseases you had in there, or anything like that?
Oh yeah, yes. Mind you, there too, like when we were in China, I remember, I don't know exactly what happened, but I do remember that for about 2 days. Like they used to send a draft, a monthly draft from the mainland of the very sick over to the island. There was a British military hospital, Bone Road Hospital. So I was very fortunate because of what happened to me. I'm not sure what happened, but I lost my sight. I couldn't walk. I couldn't distinguish hot from cold or anything like that. But I was lucky enough that this, when I had to, whatever happened to me, this, it was building up for months, but then when it happened quite suddenly. And I remember I ended up over in Bone Road Hospital. Like there was a draft going in a day or two, and I went on it. I remember our doctors complained many times to the Japanese that they let the men get too far gone. Once they went over there, there was too many of them died. There was nothing they could do for them. But I do remember I was in this hospital for about 10 and a half months. And I was in bed for about 3-4 months there, and I had to be spoon-fed. I couldn't distinguish day from night, and I couldn't feel. And eventually, I started to walk a bit, and I graduated to 2 crutches, you know. And I finally had one, and could hardly hobble, but there were some horrible sights there. And like I said, the amusing part is that some of us who were there, and who'd been on what they call the DI list, they give up hope for, and still a year later, we ended up in a bloody coal mine in Japan and produced coal for them. Mind you, even then, couldn't walk good, but managed to do the work. The mine we were at, I left, what we actually had to do, you know. And I said the average weight of our fellow there is, say, in between 110 and 115 pounds. And given a quota of coal, say 18 to 22, 23, 24 ton of coal, everybody handled that tonnage at least once, you know. On top of that, you had to bring your own, the railroad ties, the rail, carry your lighting, your air hose, and drill twice a day for blasting, you know. And like I say, if I was working a mine in Canada, I'd been rich for what I was doing in Japan there.
Did you get a pension when you came back, or did you have to fight for that?
No, I was given a 20% pension when I come back. And I spent quite a bit of time, in Deer Lodge Hospital. We had 3-4 operations. And they finally did give me 100% pension, they actually gave it to me, but I get it for about 10 or 11 different things, you know. And I remember once, a doctor in Deer Lodge Hospital, told me to go and see the Canadian Pension Advocate. Well, at that time, I was only getting a 20% pension, and they told me to go home and do nothing for a year and a half. But they also told me the same thing, I got, even at that time, I had cirrhosis of the liver. I had jaundice bad a few times. Apparently, this isn't as very effective having jaundice. I often thought, cirrhosis was strictly an alcoholic disease. I said, I didn't have time yet to be an alcoholic. And he laughed and said, it's not only just from drink that causes cirrhosis, like you get jaundice bad and that does harm to your pancreas and one thing and another. But while I was in China, I mentioned in Bone Road Hospital there, I was getting 7 needles a day for a period of about 7 months. And I've often said, I was lucky to make that draft, and in the mainland, there was nothing. There was absolutely nothing to be getting in the way of drugs that they could give you. I remember I helped bury many fellow in China and Japan, and I figured things just worked my way just perfectly, or I certainly wouldn't have got to Japan, never mind back to Canada again. But my eyesight, improved. Lots of the fellows, the eyesight has got steadily worse. Well, there, I got 2 injections a day, it's certain, for vitamin C, you know, or the average fellow, this is what we were lacking, you know. And get a half an egg maybe every second or third day, or a half a little bottle of milk, nobody got that, you know. Mm-hmm. And I've often said it wasn't for me being in that position at that time. I certainly wouldn't have got it, and that was the time I needed it the most to live. And I'm thankful that it worked out the way it did work out.
If you'd been less sick, you might not have made
That's
it.
That's right. If I'd been less sick, I might not have made it. And then possibly when I did get sick, I would have missed the boat, I would have been another one of the, like, uh, when we were in the Sipri Shinagawa, like I mentioned, is a peace hospital for all the prisoner camps around Tokyo, and that was a fantastic sight. And, like, I do remember that the Japanese, like, with our doctors, like, everybody who died, like, the first time I seen it was right at the back of our hut window, like a urinal here, and the window just identical to this one, and they had just a table there with a piece of a wooden cord wood in the back, like, for a pillow, and that side they had, like, a platform. It might be 3, 4, or 5 bodies there and one on there. Everybody died the first thing in the morning. Cut him in half and started dragging this out and cut his head there. Dead bottles of brains and livers and kidneys and Lord knows what. And these fellas, like one Jap, used to come in with a bicycle with a side cart and used to take 3 bodies on this cart at one time to the incinerator. Well, most of our original guys were all over 6 foot, you know. And these little plywood boxes that they brought in, like the way the tea comes in, about that big, and I don't know about that square. But I watched them many a time, and to get a big guy in there, it's pretty hard to do. And like often they just cut his legs and his arms and get him in there, and one chap would get up there, squeeze him down the box, and finally get the lid on there, and one chap would get up on top of the lid, and the other box would be there with a hammer and a nail, and nail the lid on, and didn't take the corpses. He'd generally have to make 2 trips a day because he could only take like 3 bodies and the side cart, and then he'd have to come back again. But then the Americans came and they bombed that incinerator. And after that, it was a daily chore for us to go out, and they said, well, your people bombed the incinerator, you've got to go out and burn your own bodies. And this is what was a daily routine after that, like in Shinagawa. Like we'd always have the corpse rolled up in a blanket, and then you'd have 4 guys in another blanket carrying a corpse. So there might be 2, 3 corpses. So this is right on the ocean front. Luckily enough, there's all kinds of timber there, like soap and oil. There was never no shortage of wood. And it was the same routine. You'd have to get a bunch of this wood, and then you just take. You always had to bring the blankets back. You never burnt the blanket. Burnt the blankets, and he'd get so callous with this, you know, and these guys like cut up, and he'd just take them and shake them out on top of that bloody heap and get a match from the Jap guard, and they'd always give you an urn. You had to bring back his ashes, you know, private so-and-so, corporal so-and-so, and well, naturally with bloody ashes, you just scooped up some ashes, and while you're burning there, you didn't make you dig some air raid shelters, or you just didn't sit and wash. They always utilize your labor too. Then when that all finished, and you'd get his ashes and bring it back, and that went on the shelf. And then, oh, we didn't mind going out there. In fact, it gave us, we looked forward to getting out on these trips, because once you're out, you're always trying to deal. As long as you could meet people, you could always maybe get some food and cigarettes or something like that. And nobody objected to going. In fact, we were only too glad to go.
Did you ever get a chance to steal much food where you were, or was it sort of out of the question?
Well, we're in our particular camp, like I say, we were in the mine like 14 days out of the 15th. The 15th day, quite often, they'd send us down to the railroad and let we'd unload the grain. Like, but the bags they had were like not 60-pound bags. And in fact, it took 2 men to handle one of these bags. This was automatically once you went down to the warehouses and to the railroad yard, like you're handling food, it made no difference. It was in the sack, the first thing, there was a hole there, and you'd have it in your pants pocket or anywhere you can carry anything at all, and made no difference what it was. Mind you, they were always watching you, and many fellas got beat up with it. And I guess there was a lot of deceiving going on, like with their own people too, you know. But you'd always, many times you'd say, even if you got some beans or something like that, and get a can and put it in water and soak the beans, and there would be half soaked, like if you soaked them for 48 hours and just eat them as they are. Well, all you'd get out of it is a damn good case of diarrhea and a sick stomach, but at least you're eating something, you know. This was automatically. If there was any place you went to, you were always looking to even see even bum or steal or get something. And this was just, like I say, second thought, just to stay alive already, you know. But everybody was exactly the same way.
Did you get paid in Japan?
Yes. Well, this was I thought they were quite smart. What they used to do, like depending how many days in a month They used to pay us 10 cents a day for the day shift and 15 cents a day for the night shift. Eh? And they didn't bring in once a month, they'd bring in maybe somebody get maybe, say, 4 or 5 or 6 apples or some type of fruit that they grew around there, or some cookies that I don't know what they're made of, half concrete and very little sugar and a little bit of barley flour or something like that. But if you worked every day of the month, you still wouldn't accumulate enough money to buy what they'd allow you. Say 5 pieces of fruit and 6 cookies. Well, what it would cost you, you couldn't get it enough because there wasn't enough days for you to work. So the idea is that naturally they wanted to get as many days' work out of the people as you can, but the money was worth nothing, because when we did leave at the end, there was a great big, an orphanage, I guess you could call it, like children, like they were bombed out for the cities, and they had some, there were some nuns in the place, and the odd occasion that there were work parties around there, they were always a little bit kind to us, you know. But I do remember when we did leave, like everything was such a short supply, but there was lots of yen, their so-called dollars. And like for instance, we had thousands of blankets. Well, you could go out and get 200 yen for a blanket. But what could you do with the 200 yen once we went to like Sendai, a great big seaport? Well, you couldn't buy nothing with money. The stores, there was nothing. There was nothing there. The money was absolutely no use to you, you know. The only thing you can get is like you take a haversack and put in some butter and some chocolate and some cigarettes and meat and stuff like that. Once you brought that out, well, then you can get some food or European potatoes or chicken dinner or something like that, or a bottle of sake, you know. But if you pulled out like yen or Canadian dollar or American dollar or English pound, well, that was nothing. They didn't want money at all. Money was no good. They would take nobody had that, our watches and everything was gone, but the odd fellow, if he managed to get a watch or a ring or anything like that, well, they talk business with that, or food or clothing, but not with money. Money is no good. And still, when we got to Tokyo, some of the Americans were giving a 25% American money for the yen. And I remember when we left, like this one Jap miner, Takahashi was his name, it means Greyhound. He was good to us. And before we left, we got a work party there. We must have got about 60, 70 Japanese, just to carry all the stuff we had from our camp over to this here orphanage, you know. It's canned everything from soup to nuts and all kinds of food and blankets and medical supplies. And the whole work we shipped it over to the orphanage. But some of these miners who were pretty good to us, God, we gave them everything, all kinds of stuff. They were really, they become rich overnight too with what we gave them. But I remember this Takahashi had 3 or 4 boys there, and I remember all the money I had, maybe a couple of hundred yen, I don't know what it was. Put it in the piggy bank, you know, probably never buy anything with it. But imagine the surprise we got when we got to Tokyo, and there the Americans were giving you 25 cents for the yen. So we didn't cash in on it. Like I say, I actually brought nothing back, you could say. Often says the only thing I want to bring back from this goddamn country is myself. I thought the prospect of doing that was pretty poor, but I managed anyway.
I don't know if you remember, but there was 2 Canadian nurses over there.
Yes, Waters was one of her name, yeah. Nurse Waters was one, and what was the other one? I can't place her. Seems to me that Nurse Waters, like she was in the West Coast here a couple of years ago, like somebody was telling me he was talking to her. Well, there they, like, everybody had a hard time, like when the Japanese took over there, like any white woman or even like the Chinese girls there, like Japs, like I say, were animals, you know. And they liked any woman, especially white or even Chinese. And like rape was really rampant there. They'd kill them one way or another, you know. Well, I forget where was in a convent where they got these two, and I imagine they got the same treatment. This is what we were told, like I wasn't there. And this is just automatically, you could say. The surprising part is that they let them live, you know, because they're like, so many of them, after they did that, they'd automatically just kill them with a sword or put a bullet in their brain and add insult to injury, like, you know. But I remember they were repatriated. I remember, like, this was, we'd only been locked up for a year, and they'd always used to spread propaganda there. We always had clubs, you know, OBE out before Easter, or OBC out before Christmas. And I remember they told us once and got everybody to put their clothes ready, the Red Cross ships were going to come in a certain day. And by this time we'd heard so many lies and probably anything to demoralize, you know. But sure enough, here where we were, and we looked, and boy, here's three lovely Red Cross ships sailing into the bloody harbor there, and a great big Red Cross on them. And they sat there for about a week, and we didn't know this until after the war was over. But we were supposed to be going on this boat, you know. But imagine that when the boat pulled out there, you know. And there was nobody, like, from our camp where we were, like, went on these ships. But apparently, like, some of the other smaller, like Stanley, I believe the Stanley prison where these two nurses were. And we had one fellow there who got into civilian clothes and ended up in Fort Stanley. And he was repatriated, although he was a Canadian soldier and wasn't entitled to such thing. But he managed to get back. I remember I bumped into him in Deer Lodge Hospital here 7-8 years ago. But there was, I don't know exactly how many who were repatriated there, but them two nurses were amongst the group on that ship when it went.
And that was while you were still in China, right?
Yeah, maybe we were locked up about a year and a half, I don't remember exactly. But
were they in the same camp as you when they were there?
No.
Or were they in?
No. Well, originally, like before the capitulation, yes. But after the fighting started, like, I remember, once the fighting started, that was the last I ever seen of them. And like, where they ended up, I guess they must have been with, like, the command, and ended up in the Stanley prison. Mm-hmm. And whereas we were miles away from there all the time, after the action started. Mm-hmm.
Well, all the questions we got to ask, if there's anything you want to say to sum it up.
Well, it's, I know, like I say, it's pretty hard. I know on different occasions I've talked with some who I consider good friends of mine, and they always tell me that I'm too hard, they gotta let bygones be bygones. I do remember I lost a very good friend of mine, like our officers, for instance, they started up in a prison camp. I remember this lousy tryst, or colonel, and they had a little detention barrack. And I remember this friend of mine, Harry Robinson, mind you, our officers, the only thing they suffered was maybe they didn't have no women there, that was about all they suffered, especially while we were in China. There's only one officer who went to Japan, and that was Captain Reed. He was our medical officer, the Grenadiers. First Crawford was our MO, and then, like, he was made brigade, the doctor for the brigade, and promoted, and we got Reed, like, as the Grenadiers MO. Well, Reed went with the big draft, and from what I understand, he conducted himself like a real man. He did an awful lot of good. Crawford, while we're in China, like, I give Crawford 100% marks. He's a damn good man. The only thing is, after we came back, he got into big things, and all he was worrying about was Crawford, whereas he could have done an awful lot of good for us. But once he took his job, he told us, once we met him, he can't give evidence in anything whatsoever. But this incident that I'm talking about, I remember, like, the officers used to lay in their huts there, and they used to bring in a canteen in them days, where maybe about 2% of the men were officers, and they used to buy 95% of that food that the Japanese paid them. Made no difference. We had money, like the Dupac market, but we couldn't buy the food from the canteen because the officers bought it all. And then they made some police and promoted them, actually, and barbed wire around their own huts to hoard this bloody food. They used to smoke there and to flick half a cigarette out where anybody was smoking. Everybody was dying for a smoke, you know. And I remember, for instance, Harry Robinson went into this gate and picked up a couple of bucks. I remember one guy, Tommy Sinclair, he still works here in the dock here at Lockport. And he used to be a cook, and they made him a sergeant. And he told him to throw them bucks away. And Harry said, "You kiss my ass, you make me throw them away, you know." And they put him up in the charge, and I remember old Tris giving 3 weeks detention, not for picking up a buck, for disobeying an order. And then in the prison camp. So they put him in the shack. Their band used to practice there about 10 hours a day. And the little bit of food we got at that time, that they wouldn't put any salt in, or wouldn't, they give them rice bust while they were in the detention barracks. Imagine that. The little bit we got from the Japs, our lousy people wouldn't even give them that. Well, I remember Robinson, like, he only spent about 2.5 weeks. In the last few days, he got dysentery. They took him to the dysentery hospital. He only lasted 4 or 5 days, and he was dead in there. And I figured, like the Hoffman says, and when we came back in the States, we met I remember there's this one woman there. She represented this, half a dozen of the leading newspapers in the States. And there were so many sworn statements, like, even though as far as our officers, that they should have been brought up in trial and court-martialed and paid the price, you know. And all this was whitewashed, and like, as far as I'm concerned, we had, I'm not saying they're all, we had some fine people within our commission rank, especially the ones that came from the COTC, like they started like early 1940, like Canadian Officers Training Corps. But the most of the senior bunch of officers we had, like I say, hell, them bastards were as bad as the Japs were worse, you know. And I always remember, like, once it's Bardell, like now he's a he wants to be one of the boys, but I remember coming back from, we were over on working at the airport, we were on the island in this camp, and this Golden and Bardell, we were A company, draw the rations. Well, working all day outside in the rain, it used to just drizzle and walk and gobs of red clay there, and miserable as hell, and come back, and I remember they used to cook everything together, we call it chow fan, you know. But then, like, they wouldn't wash the bloody sand off the little bit of vegetable there was, you know, and the rat shit and the bloody rice and pieces of string and glass and you name it, and then it was half cooked, you know. There's no excuse for this at all, you know. And I remember when we lined up to draw our rations, like A company was first, like from the officers, and they started a little bit of a riot right in the prison camp. And I remember that Lois Burdell come out, and then old Trist come along. God damn, old Trist is okay, he said. 2 minutes, he says. Anybody want to draw the ration, the food, to draw it and eat it and get away, he says, or else we'll dump it over to the seawall. Well, he said the wrong thing there, and then they started. We want the Japanese camp commandant. Well, these bastards were a lot more scared of the Japanese commandant than we were. And we were scared of them, make no mistake about that. But like a lot of them, people like I wouldn't talk to on the street today. I fear the Jap is pretty bloody low, but a lot of our people that we had, I fear, are still a few degrees lower than the Japs. And a lot of these fellas say, this thing of the past. And I said, we fought for a principle, and this is all part of it. Mm-hmm. As far as I'm concerned, a lot of them Japs, whenever I hear, like every fall when they mourn for the people that were killed in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, have often said, nothing would have given me more pleasure if I could have been released that bomb. I said, no compunction at all. I said, I've seen them kids. Every one of them had a wooden rifle there. And like the same thing, like fighting in the Southwest. I said, they can throw a grenade or a bomb and kill you just as bad. And that's what they're trained to, and that's what the propaganda is. I said, they're not human beings. I said, no, I don't see why you should have to treat them as human beings. No. But maybe I'm like too bitter. They say that's why I got ulcers.
Okay, thanks so much.